This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, it's Reverend Mio, for inviting me back. It's been a while since I've spoken on Saturday morning here, although I was here last Sunday to speak with the Gay Buddhist Sangha on aging as a Dharma gate. My topic today is different. And in addition to thanking Reverend Mio, I'd also like to thank my teacher, Agent Linda Cutts, and all the other teachers and Dharma friends who have continually pointed the way for me to be more aware of both my, shortcomings and my strengths. And I would also like to say that I hope that my talk today is encouraging for all of you in your practice. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Tova Green, and I live and work at San Francisco Zen Center, not very far from here, Page and Laguna. And currently I'm serving there in the role of director of City Center, which is one of Zen Center's three centers. The other ones are Green Gulch Farm and Tassajara Zen Nama Center. And this year, Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And 2 weeks ago, we had a whole weekend of various festivities, celebrations, ceremonies, speeches. It was quite a party, a Zen do. It was a very rich time. One of the wonderful things that happened was Richard Baker, who was our second abbot, came back and gave a Dharma talk and also spoke at a ceremony honoring our founder, Suzuki Roshi. And he apologized profoundly for some mistakes he made in the 80s that were very harmful to Zen Center, and apologized to Suzuki Roshi and apologized to Rev Anderson. It was very moving for me. I wasn't at Zen Center at that time, but I certainly read about what happened and heard about it. And he lived in the building for about a week, so that was very healing for some of us, and met with people who had practiced with him in the 80s. But there was a ceremony that touched me very deeply, which is what I want to talk about just in terms of the theme for my talk today, which is, if I had a title for my talk, I would call it Peace Bell, Turning Conflict into Connection. So part of the 50th anniversary ceremonies was a ceremony we did in the courtyard of Zen Center, where we dedicated a bell that was made for Zen Center and given as a gift to Zen Center by the person who sculpted it, whose name is Al Farrow. And it's an unusual bell. I've never seen a bell like it. It kind of looks like the sun on a pedestal, but the radiating spokes are made of bullets. So this is a bell, in a sense, it's that phrase, plows and
Swords
into plowshares, thank you. Swords into plowshares comes up because it was made out of weapons. And in the ceremony dedicating the bell, our abbess, Christina Lanehair, who was the doshi, the officiant for that ceremony that awakened and empowered the sound of the bell, she said that that the spell crafted from bullets and war materials is reminding us that when we reflect on our intention, we can change the world, and that the power of intention allows us to see how we can do that. May the sound of the bell always remind us of the capacity in each of us to be at peace and to manifest peace. So, you know, it reminded me of the biblical verse, and everyone neath their vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid, and into plowshares turn their swords, nations shall wage war no more. I think one reason why this touched me very deeply is that I thought of myself throughout much of my life, or most of my life, as someone who has been working for peace in the world and in my community from the time I was in college, which was during the time of the Vietnam War. And there was one other thing about the bell that really touched me. I reread the part of Suzuki Roshi's biography, Crooked Cucumber, that talks about how during World War II, Suzuki Roshi, who was not in favor of the war, had to relinquish the big temple bell in his temple, Rinzo-in, as did priests all over Japan, because it was needed, the metal was needed by the Navy and was going to be melted down for ship propellers. And it was heartbreaking for him, and there's a description of him standing at the temple gates as the bell was being removed and just being so disheartened by that. And then I wondered how Suzuki Roshi would feel today if he were to see this bell made of bullets find a home at Zen Center. So in that ceremony, I did feel the strands of my life that have to do with practice and activism coming together. And before I went to Tassajara in the year 2000, I was working for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and I had many friends who were activists. And while I was at Tassajara, I asked a question. I asked it of myself, I asked it of various teachers, and I heard other students asking the question about how sitting on a cushion in a remote valley in the wilderness could contribute to world peace. And maybe some of you have had that question, how does our practice contribute to world peace? So having the bell made of bullets at Zen Center in the heart of the city, in the place where I live and practice, reminds me of the relationship between inner peace and peace in our communities and in the wider world. But when, you know, peace can be thought of and sought after in many different realms of our lives. And I think of, you know, the Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who uses the phrase being peace. And he certainly, from the days when he was young and still living in Vietnam, and founded a group of young monks and nuns to help him, bringing food to people in Vietnam who were poor and doing other acts of social service, really advocating as an exile from Vietnam to end the war, he talks about being peace, and peace is every step, and you know how peace can permeate our ways of walking, our ways of communicating, our ways of interacting with each other and our sanghas. So in terms of many ways of working for peace in the world and many issues upon which any one of us could focus our energy, working to reduce world hunger or to bring medical care to those in war zones. I have a friend who was a nurse at the hospice where I worked to join Doctors Without Borders and is now in Africa, developing nonviolent alternatives to war. But another way of working for peace is to foster connections between people we know, between ourselves and others, and particularly across our differences. And perhaps this is one of the basic principles in all the ways we might be working for peace, to be able to communicate with people who may think differently from us or who've had different life experiences from us. So in thinking about this talk, I asked our abbot, Steve Stuckey, what his thoughts are about being peace. He comes from a Mennonite family and has been also working for peace in various ways throughout his life. And he said he thinks of being peace as not creating enemies. And that's the core of his practice. So that includes being open to everyone, to both people we might feel drawn to and people we might feel some aversion to or difficulty connecting with. But it's all about finding connection. And he said it begins by noticing feelings in our bodies, our emotions, and our thoughts, which we become more aware of through practice. So in terms of being able to communicate around differences, I thought I would perhaps share two experiences from my earlier life that might I've been thinking about, you know, what were the causes and conditions that led me to be so concerned about peace and about communication and about wanting to understand and befriend and support people who are different from me. So I think one of the memories that comes up for me is when I was a teenager. I have a younger sister whose name is Helen. And when we were both in high school, we went to different high schools. But Helen wanted to date a boy at school who invited her out, who was Puerto Rican. And when she talked to my mother about this, my mother got very upset and said, no, she just said, you can't, I won't, you know, you can't go out with Jose. It's just not acceptable. And I thought that was really unfair. And I spoke up on my sister's behalf. And my mother got very upset with me. And she's like, well, let's talk with your father about this. And so my father talked with all of us and just got very angry with my sister and me for upsetting our mother. And that was, couldn't talk about it after that. They just didn't want to hear our concerns. And it felt very unfair to me. And I later went to Antioch College and then transferred to UC Berkeley. And, you know, I learned a whole lot more about civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in college. And in the summer before my senior year at college, Antioch had many Quakers in the school. It was at the time the president of Antioch was a Quaker, and I went to Quaker meetings and I learned about the work of the American Friends Service Committee. So in 1963, in the summer, I signed up for a voter registration project in Greensboro, North Carolina, and I was part of a group of black and white college students. We stayed in the basement of a black church in Greensboro and went out every day to register black people so they could vote. And it was during the time when there had been sit-ins in Woolworths in Greensboro, which was segregated. And I just learned so much. Having grown up in New York, I was kind of shocked at what it was like in the South. So far from my experience of going to a high school that was multiracial, having friends who were from different backgrounds than my own. And I was very fortunate because at the end of our time in Greensboro, we all got on a bus and had a police escort out of town because we were an integrated group, and we went to the March on Washington in 1963, which was a life-changing experience for me. hearing Martin Luther King give his talk, I Have a Dream. And I think that, you know, that having that kind of experience as a young person, I think really did help to change my life in a way that there's no going back after that. And you really see the power of so many thousands of people marching together and in a nonviolent way, and kids from freedom schools in the South and union members, black and white, and clergy and students. It was coming together of so many groups of people to express a vision of a world in which we there's more equity and accessibility for all people, the basic things we all need. So so I think the civil rights movement of the 60s, with its emphasis on nonviolent ways to foster what Martin Luther King Jr. called beloved community, combined with all the structural legislative changes, had a deep impact on white Americans as well as black. And it brought to light the extent of white power and privilege in this country. But the civil rights movement didn't put an end to racism. And I think the work of healing this racism, which is part, it's so endemic in our society, sometimes we don't recognize it if we're white. So since getting or becoming part of the Buddhist Sangha after I moved to the Bay Area, I began being more aware of efforts within the Buddhist community to address racism. When I first moved to the Bay Area, I lived in Oakland and I went to Green Gulch for Zazen on Sundays, the public program, and then I also sat at the Berkeley Zen Center during the week. And I moved here in 1990, and in the 90s there was a group that formed of people from different sanghas, and we met and had, I remember, one day-long workshop on the theme of healing racism in our sanghas, and put together a booklet with writings from Buddhists of color and white allies on the work that we thought was important to do, telling our stories. And that was the beginning of my commitment to work on this issue at Zen Center. And then I joined the board of Zen Center, and at that time there was a newly reformed, there had been a committee before, called the Diversity and Multiculturalism Committee, which I've been part of for over 10 years. And we've been working on how to create a community that's more inclusive, not just welcoming. I think welcoming is really important, and City Center has had a reputation for not being very friendly, so we've been really working on that over the last number of years, and I think that has shifted. But how to be welcoming and inclusive of people with differences and enable people to feel that they can not only come to Zen Center but become part of Zen Center and take on leadership roles at Zen Center. Almost all of our teachers and priests are at Zen Center are white, and I think we're slowly working on that, but it's going to take a while to change. The diversity committee, I don't know how much in detail I should go into this, because Hartford Street, although Hartford Street Zen Center is an affiliated sangha, you're not really officially one of the three centers of Zen Center, but I think the same issues probably arise here. So I will just say a little bit about the diversity committees. mission statement, because I think it expresses an aspiration. It's like the Bodhisattva vow. We work towards it, but it's so enormous. How can we actually achieve it? The Diversity and Multiculturalism Committee is committed to working at every level of San Francisco Zen Center's organization to uproot all forms of oppression, subtle and gross, especially towards people who have been traditionally marginalized, so that our differences can be celebrated and enjoyed in harmony. Crucial to our efforts is recording, acknowledging, and building upon the diversity and multiculturalism work that has been done at San Francisco Zen Center by those who have come before us. In keeping with the central vow of the Soto Zen tradition and the way of practice established by Shunryu Suzuki, the Diversity and Multiculturalism Committee is dedicated to each and all of us realizing our true nature. May people of every race, nationality, class, gender, sexual orientation, age, and physical ability be warmly welcomed and truly supported to join, realize, and embody this way of life. So recently, just before the weekend when we celebrated our 50th anniversary, a group of us started meeting to talk about having some further training at San Francisco Zen Center on white privilege, and we use the term cultural competence. And this came about because earlier this summer, there was a one-day people of color sitting, which we haven't had before at Zen Center, at least since I can remember. Maybe in the earlier days there was such a one-day sitting. And people in that group wanted to continue to meet and have a weekly or bi-weekly people of color sitting group. And the person who was asked to lead that group felt that in order for people in such a group to feel truly honored and welcomed at Zen Center, we had to do some work on our white privilege. So I feel very fortunate to be part of a committee which includes two of our abbots and the head of practice at City Center and our diversity coordinator to begin to plan some trainings on white racism. Excuse me, white privilege. I think the word racism can be very... I think none of us is intentionally racist, and it's really better to think about and look at white privilege and white power than white racism, so I apologize for that word just slipped out. And I think also as white people learning how to be allies to people of color, but also to one another as we begin to do this work, because it's difficult sometimes to recognize our biases. We may not see them because we grew up with them. They're part of our conditioning, so it takes some effort to become a little more aware. As we were beginning to launch this process of finding a trainer, at our 50th anniversary celebration, there was a woman who came who was African American who experienced a number of things that were painful to her. And after the ceremonies on Saturday, she wrote a blog which was widely distributed through the People of Color listserv about her experience at Zen Center. And when I first read it and read all the comments on the blog, I felt kind of disheartened. You know, we were just beginning to get something off the ground, and there were people sharing feelings about thoughts and feelings and experiences about Zen Center of times when they had not felt welcomed, and or at times one of the things this writer expressed was over the course of one day at Zen Center. She'd come in the morning and then come to the Zen Do in the evening. At least 10 people had commented on her hair. and she felt objectified by that. And there were other things she wrote about as well. But as I thought about it more, and all of the people in our committee, the abbots and president and various other people, looked at the blog, and we were trying to think about the best way to respond to it. There was, in just a few days later, Mushin Ikeda, who's a teacher at the East Bay Meditation Center, came and gave a talk at City Center. And her talk was called Daylighting the Hidden Streams, Why Our Stories Matter. And in her talk, she spoke about the need for us, particularly as allies of people of color or people in other traditionally marginalized groups, to work with the concept of cultural humility. And when I heard her talk about cultural humility, it felt much more valuable to me than the idea of cultural competence. So if we think about cultural humility and personal humility of being aware of all that we don't know, being aware that our views are conditioned, it allows us to listen in a much more, open way to people whose experience is different from ours. So, and Mushin also proposed that when we talk about right speech, which is one of the parts of the Eightfold Noble Path, that we could add to that right listening and right storytelling, and creating spaces for people to tell their stories and to listen in a deeply respectful way. And she offered a definition of cultural humility. It's an attitude of respect when approaching people of different cultures, which entails engagement in a process of self-reflection and self-critique, requiring an ability to move beyond one's own biases. So, I think Zazen is a wonderful way to, cultivate that kind of openness and awareness that our views can change, our experience can, our experience of ourselves and our and of others can be more spacious, and also it's a way in which we can develop compassion towards ourselves and towards others. I think of the passage from the Genjo Koan, where Dogen describes riding out in a boat to the midst of the ocean where no land is in sight, and viewing the four directions and seeing the ocean as circular. But he says the ocean it's only circular because we see it that way from that perspective. And like practice, we see and understand only what our eye of practice can reach at a given moment. He talks about how to a fish, the ocean is a palace. It's not, it's not round, it's not square, it's like a jewel. So, understanding how our experience shapes how we meet another person can be very helpful in just opening our perspective and having that sense that we don't necessarily know what someone else, we can't know actually what someone else's stories are until we listen to them. I want to leave some time for questions, so just going to share one more thing that arose after this first blog. When Mushin Ikeda came to give her talk, she brought with her the new co-director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, a woman named Dawn Haney. And after Dawn's visit to Zen Center, Dawn also wrote a blog on the Buddhist Peace Fellowship Turning Wheel website. And one of the things she said I found very helpful, she said, when an organization takes on diversity work, they should expect more critique rather than less. And she said, I expect as an individual and as part of an institution that I and institutions will continue to make mistakes. But can we learn from these mistakes, deal with the consequences, seek understanding and dialogue? So Dawn said at the end of her blog, I hope that mostly white U.S. Buddhist organizations can engage deeply in unraveling racism. Is this not the same work of practicing with egolessness, of letting what we cling to unravel? I think of my Zen friends in particular as skilled at this practice of dropping the ego. May the 50 years of strong community practice at San Francisco Zen Center allow folks to bring their most gracious and open selves to the work of unraveling racism. So just to return to the image of the peace bell, and the bell was designed initially for a concert, which we called Resounding Compassion. And when I see the bell in the courtyard and sound the bell, I think of that phrase, Resounding Compassion. And can we bring that to our work for peace in ourselves and also in our communities and in the world? And with an open heart and mind and awareness of our privilege, can we approach cultural differences with humility and kindness? So, thank you very much for listening, and I'd be interested if you have any comments. Yes.
What a wonderful talk. What an absolutely timely and wonderful talk, and bringing up within me things that I've in two ways to go to board meetings to say and think about cultural sensitivity and a generally white face and this sonder. I'm immensely grateful for so many of the concepts you outlined there as a way of sort of getting your head on around the how you start and you did so many things. I'm really grateful. I would add one thing that I thought might be added, if I may.
Hey, please.
Rightly or wrongly, I perceive me as Jewish. I perceive myself as homosexual, and probably most of the people here. And I think that people who themselves, I felt so skinny in society, can add another tool, which is to reflect back on how they felt with regard to these experiences. And it humbles. That's how that felt to me. If I wanted to surround somebody else, might it feel the same way? That's all I think. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for bringing that up. You know, I was going to talk about how, for me, coming out as a lesbian in the 70s was difficult. Actually, in the 60s, even more difficult. I think that also sensitized me to the struggles of other people who have been oppressed because, being Jewish probably has something to do with it as well. Being a woman. I think any of those ways in which we're part of a group that has less power or privilege can help us understand what it's like for someone in another group. So I thank you very much for sharing that, bringing that into the mix. Yes.
And just thank you for the talk. I just had two comments. First was when I was at City Center, I walked into the courtyard. I thought, wow, I thought the bell was so beautiful. And then I walked up to it close and sort of had this horrified reaction because I didn't realize what the sort of the rays were made out of until I got up close. And then you step back again, and it's beautiful again. So just thought that was kind of interesting, you know, how that kind of had that impact. And the other thing was just the thank you for taking that, this, you know, this kind of work on. And this isn't the only thing you've done. You've done a lot of stuff with the queer community as well over at City Center. And obviously, they get faced with a lot of stuff, and I'm glad to see you guys kind of take that stuff head on. We exist at this location partially because there was, you know, sort of a lack of, or there were people who felt there was a lack of support in a certain diverse culture. But I just wanted to express my gratitude to you specifically for the work that you do. You know, in this, I guess, initiative that you're taking on, but also the work that you do with the Queer Dharma group and the other work you do over at the City Center. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. I wanted to mention, actually, that our Queer Dharma group meets once a month, and we'll be meeting next Saturday from 1:30 to 3:30, so if any of you would like to come, please do. And, you know, say, I don't know, fortunately or unfortunately, I'll be the speaker again next Saturday. But I will talk about something different. Thank you very much for that. Susie?
I just want to get clarification. Is it September 1st from 1 to 3 or 1:30 to 3:30?
Did I say 1 to 3? It's 1 to 3.
Yeah, okay.
1 to 3. Yes.
If I'm understanding correctly, there was an event to try to foster not necessarily cultural competence, but cultural participation from a diverse group of people, people of color. And the question is, I'm wondering how many people of color from the audience that you were looking to bring in were involved in the planning of the activity and the setup of it.
Well, there are a couple of activities that haven't happened yet. There was a one-day sitting for people of color that happened at Zen Center, and out of that, a request to have an ongoing people of color sitting group, which hasn't happened yet. And in order for that to happen, we were asked to do some training on our white privilege and cultural, I would now say cultural humility, throughout Zen Center. And that hasn't happened yet because we're in the process of looking for a trainer. And there is a person of color who's part of that planning group. But I think the training will be for white people first, and then once we get our act together a little better, we might include people of color, because there are some people of color who live at Zen Center, and certainly some many who come. Does that answer your question, or what were you saying? I'm not sure what.
Well, I have so many thoughts about these subjects. I wondered if there were people of color involved in the organizing of whatever the events are and whatever direction it is that you're wanting to move the overriding organization in.
Yes, we on our Diversity and Multiculturalism Committee, which now we changed the name to Cultural Awareness and Inclusivity Committee. The language keeps changing, as you know. When I first came out, it was just gay culture and gay and lesbian and LGBT and LGBTIQ. Anyway, so similarly with diversity work, the language keeps changing. But there are people of color on our committee. But I think, you know, for this training, we're looking for a white trainer because I think we need to work on a white issues, and that is actually what the person of color who's working on this interviewing committee thinks is best as well. So we are very much listening to people of color who are part of our sangha around this.
Yeah,
excuse me? Someone else have
Julie's? Tova, I just wanted to thank you for sort of publicly coming out and talking about, especially the blog. There were a couple of blogs and that were kind of circulating just a couple of weeks ago. And I read that particular blog, and it was very thoughtful. Mm-hmm. It came really from a good place, this African American woman. Mm-hmm. And she was very, very clear that it was her experience, that she wasn't speaking for anybody but herself. Mm-hmm. And just to respond to you, I was at that POC one day sitting, and it was, there is a person of color that's totally involved in the process and the events, and it was thought, it was kind of consensus that this person, this trainer, should be a white person training allies. So it's just it's a one step. It's a challenge, but I think that Zen Center is really trying to respond. Thank you.
You're welcome. I will say that the response that the abbots decided was the best to the blog was to invite the person who wrote the blog to come and meet face-to-face and have a conversation. We did feel her willingness to do that in what she wrote. And, you know, I think the blog actually came at a really good time to wake us all up. And I appreciate the way she wrote it. Initially, I was taken aback by it because I thought, oh, well, you know, she doesn't know. We're really working on this, but we have more work to do. So it was well
and
said.
Also, if she had felt those things, it's possible, it's probably that a lot of other people have.
Oh, absolutely.
And certainly, it's not always easy being in testing.
Yes, I know. And I know other people have felt that, and not all of them have written blogs. So, you know, here's thanks to someone who did.
But thank you really for this speech at this particular time.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming. And I would encourage you, you know, if you ever look on the San Francisco Zen Center website for the talks, all of our talks are recorded and available to listen to. The one by Moshe is a really beautiful talk, and I would highly recommend it. It was given last week ago, Wednesday. So it's up there. So I want to thank you very much for your attention and this thoughtful discussion. And I can stay a little while. I have a friend in the hospital who I was going to go and see after this. So. But if any of you want to chat with me over tea for a little while, I'd be happy to hear other questions or comments. And thanks a lot.